Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Marianne Combs. Good morning. This is NPR News. Later in the hour, we'll talk fortunes and philanthropy with author Lisa Napoli. She's the author of the book Ray and Joan about the founder of McDonald's and his wife. First, it's time to check in with political junkie Ken Rudin. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Marianne.
So, pronouncements coming from the president-elect's office regarding appointments. This morning we learned that former presidential candidate Dr. Ben Carson will be heading Housing and Urban Development, an area which, as a former pediatric neurosurgeon, he doesn't really have any experience in. In fact, I believe earlier this month when his name was floated out there as a possible appointee, his close friend Armstrong Williams told The Hill that Dr. Carson feels he has no government experience. He's never run a federal agency. The last thing he would want to do is take a position that could cripple the presidency. Now, of course, earlier this morning on Morning Edition, Williams said, oh, no, that was not a correct quote. He actually does have good skills that he can transfer to this position. What are we to make of this?
Well, I'm smiling throughout your whole explanation because the way you described it is exactly what happened when Ben Carson's name was floated a while ago. Armstrong Williams did say, look, he doesn't have the experience to run an agency. Of course, it was interesting that he had the experience to run for president, but not to run a federal agency.
You're right.
But you're absolutely right. Ben Carson has no experience in government, in running a bureaucracy. He has no experience in housing policy, other than the fact that when he was young, he lived in public housing. But this is a $47 billion budget. It takes a lot of know-how and wherewithal to run a thing like this. And of course, we always like to remember every time that Donald Trump offers a cabinet post to somebody he once ran against, we always like to remind us of what he said about his opponents. And we remember Donald Trump calling Ben Carson pathological. And I think at one point he conflated Ben Carson's life story with that about child molestation. Jeez. I mean, it's just, and of course we know about Mitt Romney and what Mitt Romney said about Donald Trump. And apparently Mitt Romney remains in the running for Secretary of State. But it's interesting about the choices he's made, especially Ben Carson, because as you say, no experience, no wherewithal and a knowledge, apparent knowledge of how to run a bureaucracy like this. But here we are.
You mentioned Secretary of State. Now, how are things progressing with that? We've talked about Mitt Romney. And then this morning, word of ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson is a possible candidate for Secretary of State.
Wouldn't that be something? I mean, that would be the ideal cabinet nominee for somebody in the Donald Trump cabinet, the president and CEO of ExxonMobil. But the point is, a lot of people have been talking about the problems filling the positions in the Trump administration and the Trump cabinet. That's really overblown. I think that Donald Trump is far ahead of recent predecessors as far as naming members of the cabinet. But Secretary of State seems to be the sticking point. Obviously, we've gone over and over the things that Donald Trump and Mitt Romney have said about each other in 2016. And then, of course, once they floated, the Trump people floated the name of Mitt Romney, Secretary of State. You see Kellyanne Conway going wherever she's asked to say how dreadful and awful a Mitt Romney appointment would be. So you see Rex Tillerson of ExxonMobil. You see John Huntsman, the former governor of Utah, who briefly ran for president in 2012 and was President Obama's choice for ambassador to China. So, you know, those names are out there. But, you know, the original list of Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani and David Petraeus, they apparently remain on the list, but other names are being added almost daily.
Now, Donald Trump has said that he would appoint retired Marine General James Mattis as defense secretary. He has the reputation for being very outspoken. Is he a good fit for the Trump cabinet?
Well, you know something, I kind of think the answer is yes. I think he's highly regarded. I think he's not as prone to say some outrageous things as Michael Flynn, the national security advisor, has said. I mean, he's talked about, you know, let's, you know, lock Hillary up. That's kind of what you don't expect to hear about a national security advisor. But the new defense secretary designate seems to be widely regarded. He is a hardliner. But look, the argument, the Trump argument against the Obama foreign policy was that it was, in their words, weak and feckless. And the new choices for defense and foreign policy are anything but that.
So what does this say about our foreign policy as it relates to Iran and Syria?
Well, it's a complicated foreign policy thing because as much as, I mean, one, clearly Donald Trump has made it clear that he does not support going to war or certainly troops on the ground against Assad in Syria. He certainly has made complimentary comments about Putin, Vladimir Putin, and vis-a-vis his policy in Syria. And it was interesting, while Donald Trump seems to be saying nice things about some erstwhile enemies like Putin, he had this congratulatory phone call he accepted from the president of Taiwan mm-hmm. over the weekend. And that, I mean, look, Mike Pence says, well, wait a second. It's okay for Barack Obama to praise Fidel Castro, the murderous thug Fidel Castro, but he can't take a complimentary, a congratulatory phone call from the president of Taiwan. But as anybody knows, the relationship between China and Taiwan, that it's very fraught with danger and distrust. So while it just seems very simplistic to say, well, all he did was get a congratulatory phone call, China feels that any reaching out, any conversation by a U.S. president and the president of Taiwan is just asking for trouble. And as it turns out, it looks like there's been no such conversation with a U.S. president and a Taiwanese president since the 1970s. So while Trump will say, well, maybe this is just a thank you very much, congratulations phone call, it did seem to be a break in protocol, and it has seemingly upset a lot of people, not only in the Far East, but around the world.
Well, and then yesterday afternoon, Trump tweeted, did China ask us if it was okay to devalue their currency, making it harder for our companies to compete, heavily tax our products going into their country, or to build a massive military complex in the middle of the South China Sea? I don't think so.
Well, that's perfect Donald Trump. I mean, I think that it's clear that the two, if you look at the tweets, it's clear that the two biggest obstacles and perhaps enemies in Donald Trump's mind is China and Saturday Night Live. I mean, those seem to be the real enemies of freedom around the world. And I mean, the fact that this is the president-elect, and on a Sunday evening after midnight, a Saturday evening or early Sunday morning after midnight, when he says, I just started watching, I watched Saturday Night Live, it's unwatchable, it's biased, it's not funny, sad. This is what the president-elect of the United States is focusing on, parody on late-night television. So right. I would think that somehow China, as Alex Baldwin would say it, Alec Baldwin would say it, I think somehow the issues of China and foreign policy and things like that are certainly more pressing than how Saturday Night Live portrays him.
Which was interesting. And of course, the story this weekend was that Saturday Night Live did a skit about Donald Trump and how much he tweets compulsively. And then within an hour, he tweeted about their skit.
Isn't that perfect? It's like you can't make this stuff up. And one more thing, I don't know if we have time, but if we want to go, because I heard it during I was listening to it, of course, during the newscast, the story about the oil pipeline and how environmentalists and Native Americans have gotten this big victory in North Dakota. But the point is, Donald Trump won, is going to take office in about 47, 46 days, and his policy is complete opposite of what the Department of Army said this weekend regarding the North Dakota Sioux tribe. And two, Donald Trump owns stock in the company that's building the pipeline. So, for all the celebratory actions and words you've heard in the past day over what's happened in North Dakota, that policy can clearly be reversed in 46, 47 days.
Right. And we've mentioned earlier that we've talked with reporter Dan Gunderson, saying that there are many protesters up there that are saying that they are not leaving anytime soon for just that very reason.
Right.
Now, getting back to the China and Taiwan and Twitter, how do you think the State Department is feeling right now?
Well,
how do you prepare for this or handle it?
See, the thing is, the State Department is the State Department. It doesn't get a total unraveling every time there's a new president in office. So there's a lot of bureaucracy in there that wants to work with a new president, whether it's Barack Obama or Donald Trump. But the State Department's goal is obviously to make some semblance of normalcy in the world. And when you have, look, clearly the Trump campaign and Donald Trump himself, a lot of what their rhetoric and campaign was about was how everything was not going well under Barack Obama. So you knew that Trump was going to institute change. And there are a lot of people who felt that change is definitely needed, given a seeming indifference on Obama's part on what's going on with, like, for example, the slaughter that's going on in Syria. So you could make the argument that change was needed, but there were so many things, the Taiwan phone call, just one example of so many things that puts these State Department officials on either, you know, they don't even have time to roll their eyes or shake their head because, as I say, 47 days from now, a new foreign policy is going to take over and their jobs are going to be much more complicated.
Yeah, and these are people who are often working for years on developing relationships only to have a tweet go out that could ruin years worth of work.
Exactly. Democrats or Republicans. They're, right, people who are just working for U.S. interests around the world. Exactly.
Yeah. And Nancy Pelosi spoke on Face the Nation on Sunday, sounding pretty much the same as she always does. Is she the right person to lead the Democratic minority at this point?
Well, you know, if you're Tim Ryan and you're some of the Rust Belt Democrats who said that the Democratic Party has lost its way, you can make the argument that no, she's not. I mean, in some of their words, she is this elite. She comes from this elite district in San Francisco, which is not the representative of all the Democrats who were dissatisfied with what's going on with the economy and jobs and things like that. And she was not the right person. But at the same time, I think the election was 134-63. She was renominated by the Democrats to be their minority leader in the House. And she raises money for them. She protects them. She does everything she can to expand her Democratic contingent in the House. But the fact is that in at least the 2010, 2014, and again in 2016, Democrats did not make the inroads they hoped to make. As a matter of fact, in 2010, where they lost 63 seats, they lost more in 2014. They feel that the Democratic Party is not as they didn't learn the lesson from what the 2016 presidential election was all about. But again, I mean, you know, you had Tim Ryan may not have been the perfect messenger, but that's the same thing is going on with the Democratic National Committee chairmanship. We know that Keith Ellison is among those who wants to be the new chair of the DNC, but there are a lot of Democrats out there say that listen to what the voters had to say in November. You know, as I'm saying that, I'm saying, wait a second, the voters, by more than 2 million voters, said that Hillary Clinton should be the president. But the fact is, Donald Trump is the president. Won states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Ohio, and states and Michigan, states that nobody expected him to win. And these are Democrats. These are unhappy voters who need to be heard.
So what do you think of Keith Ellison and his candidacy for the DNC chair?
He's a progressive guy. He speaks a lot of their language, but we know that there's a lot of this rising opposition among Jewish groups who talk about his positions on Israel and Louis Farrakhan and all these things that it was probably bubbling under the surface for years. There are a lot of people, I don't even know what the word lot means, but there is an unhappiness or a nervousness or an unease, the fact that one of two Muslim Americans in Congress is going to want to be the chair of the DNC. Now, what I'm saying is not suggesting for a second that Muslim Americans should not be hosting, running the DCCC or the DNC or anything. But you know that there are people in the Trump administration who would love to have a Muslim running the DNC, because we've seen us against them run by the Trump campaign for much of the campaign, and that campaign of vendettas and us against them shows no sign of letting up.
Yeah, and last hour we were talking about the future of journalism, especially the challenges of covering a Trump presidency. Any thoughts? I mean, it seems like you've undergone your own sort of, you've changed the way you're reporting and covering things in the past few years in the campaign and the lead up to Trump's election?
I have. And you know, something I've been doing this for decades, for many years, all my 20 years or so work as NPR's political editor. I was never a D or an R or a liberal or conservative. I found good and bad in both sides, and I continue to do so. But regarding the treatment of the press, never in my life, and we could talk about Richard Nixon, we could even talk about Barack Obama and trying to expose leaks and tight control of the press, but I've never seen a candidate who had, at least a presidential a winner, who has such contempt, open contempt, for not only certain reporters, but even the Second Amendment. And I'm among those who are nervous. Look, the rest of the country may not care about the media. They may feel that the media have too much power, and Donald Trump exposed the what's wrong with the media. But I kind of feel that when you have a president who has shows such contempt for the press, it could only just be bad news for a democracy that really has its work cut out for itself for the next 4 years.
Ken, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Marianne, why am I always so negative and unhappy when I'm on this show? What's wrong with me?
We're going to work to lighten it
happen?
Up. Next time
Please.
We'll talk about the arts, Ken. We'll talk. We'll,
yeah, and
we'll,
can, candy.
Yeah.
Candy, yeah. Okay.
All right. Next week. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you.
Bye. We've been talking with political junkie Ken Rudin.